All right. Let's call this the meeting of the House and Health and Social Services to order. It is 3:05 p.m., February 13th, 2014. Present, we have Representative Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, and myself, Representative Higgins. And let the record show reflect that we have a quorum. Let's see here. Our House Recording Secretary is Butch Carver. Our LIO moderator is Shane Rudd. And my committee aide is Julie Morris. So if anybody in the audience needs anything, raise your hand, get her attention. She'll come help you if we can. It's been a long day. If your phone rings while in my committee, you owe us donuts. So, and we're all hungry. So not that I want your phone to ring, but if it does, I like chocolate donuts. So let's try to turn them off if we can. Okay, well, today we are hearing two bills. And today we have a committee substitute, I believe. May I have a motion to bring CS for the HB 269 version of LS 1251-U before the committee?
So move.
Okay. Hearing no objections, CS HB 269 version U is before the committee for discussion. With that, we'll ask the sponsor to come forward, put your name on record, and let's begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Steve Thompson, representative from House District Number 3, and with me is my Chief of Staff, Jane Pearson, who is the expert. But I'll start. Thank you for hearing House Bill 269 today. It's an act providing immunity for certain licensed temporary health care providers who provide free health care services. House Bill 269 was drafted due to liability concerns surrounding an inaugural Alaska Mission of Mercy, a.k.a. MOM, event organized by the Alaska Dental Society and scheduled in Anchorage this coming April. The Mission of Mercy program was started by a group of dentists 13 years ago in Virginia, and commonly known as MOM programs, provide free dental care to local residents who would not otherwise have access to affordable dental care. To date, the Mission of Mercy program in Alaska has 187 dentist volunteers. Seven are from out of state. The AK MOM program will provide extractions, fillings, cleanings, as well as other procedures that can be appropriately performed in a mission setting. Out-of-state dental professionals will be licensed to provide pro bono service under courtesy licenses issued by the Alaska Board of Dental Examiners. A courtesy license is a medical professional license issued by the board for the purpose of providing free services and enforcing state disciplinary provisions. The issue is that there is no clear answer as to whether an out-of-state dentist professional issued a courtesy license is covered under Alaska Statute 0965-300. AS 0965-300 provides statutory immunity against civil damages resulting from an act or omission of a health care provider who provides free health care service within the scope of their license. Under AS 0965-300, a patient must receive written notice of this immunity as well as giving informed consent before they are medically serviced, their medical service is provided. Under AS 0965-300, patients still have the right to sue the medical provider for civil damages resulting from the provider's gross negligence or reckless or intentional misconduct. Unfortunately, an attorney general's opinion indicated that it would take a court case to definitively decide if courtesy licenses have protections. The original intent of the statute was to allow retired Alaska physicians to volunteer their services. The Department of Law opines that the meaning of the law as to out-of-state providers will ultimately have to be interpreted by the court. HB 269 will clarify AS 0965-300, ensuring that civil immunity is extended to these out-of-state medical professionals who are licensed to provide dental service in Alaska during the Mission of Mercy event without having the issue come before a lengthy proceedings before the court. And that's what the bill is all about, and I urge your support.
Okay. Well, a couple of questions that we have. I think when, and I believe we have some people in the audience that could help us with some questions, too, as we go further down this path. But one of the questions was, it had to deal with more or less with military dentists, if I remember correctly, that want to volunteer their time for this important event that we're going to do. And so talking with, like you had just said earlier, one of the legal opinions is basically from the AG is that, well, we don't know unless we go to a court. You know, but right now their opinion is they are covered. You know, the immunity status kind of covers them with it. But so we'll work on that issue. So before we start, is there any questions from the committee that they want to ask the sponsor? If not, then I think you have a couple people here ready to testify, right?
Yes, we do.
Let's bring them forward, and if they could put their name on record for us and their affiliation. And I guess while we're waiting for Dave to come up forward, I will tell the committee the conflict of interest is I am also a dentist. So,
and Mr. Chair, if you choose to try to excuse yourself, I will object. So,
okay, good. I just had to bring that out there. Put yourself on record, Dave.
For the record, Mr. Chair, I'm David Logan. I'm a dentist here in Juneau, and I'm representing the Alaska Dental Society.
Okay. So, as you heard me earlier state, when me and you have had conversations on this, and one of the issues was that you brought up was the military dentist. Is that right? And this bill would help us in that area. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. As a general rule, the military dentists do not carry what we call personal protection policies, or what's generally referred to as malpractice policies. Some do that are working outside the base, moonlighting, so to speak, there in private offices, but the majority, because they're practicing on military bases, do not carry malpractice insurance.
Okay. And then you probably didn't we put this on basis earlier today because we just received this a few hours ago. This was from an attorney out of Anchorage, and he had a concern. We wasn't, you know, exactly sure whether or not it's even a concern or not. And his basically concern is he wanted to know if you don't have a copy of. Do we have copies of this so we can get it?
Yes.
I don't know if Dave's got a copy of this or not, so that you can read along with me, because you may be able to answer this for us. If not, we'll see if we can get clarification. So I'll read it. Basically, his concern was this. How would the temporary courtesy provider licensed and envisioned in A1 square with the requirements for a temporary permit under AS 864-270 in the proposed changes to AS 0965-300-C1? The bill removes the requirement for state licensing. Does this mean that someone other than a state medical board would have the authority to license physicians under this approach? This would seem to create a very ambiguous situation with regarding to licensing, and at the very least, remove the state licensing requirement may prompt a conflict with the state medical board and the Alaska Medical Association. Is that a concern that we need to be worried about, or?
Mr. Chair, while I'm not an attorney, I'll attempt to play one for the next couple of minutes there.
I don't mean to sucker punch you with that one either, but we just got it too, so.
HB 69 extends the current statute, 0965-300, and part in 09365, I'll go ahead and read the part that pertains here. In this paragraph, healthcare provider includes a healthcare provider holds a temporary courtesy license as a healthcare provider under 080162. 080162 deals specifically with courtesy licenses that are issued. The statute that you're referring to is for a different license. It's for what's considered a temporary license. And while it may seem that they're sort of the same thing, in fact, they're actually quite different. A temporary license is issued under 08-064-270. The prime difference between that is you can go out and work in any capacity as a physician. In this case, it's under the medical statutes, and earn money doing so. Where under the courtesy licenses, that's not the case. They're reserved for unique situations, and they're specified under regulations in the various professions. And so while there is a temporary license under the physicians, there is also, if you read the regulations, and I can't quote it off the top of my head, they specify specifically a courtesy license under there. And again, the differential being a temporary license essentially is more like for a locum tenens type situation, somebody who's working temporarily, where a courtesy license is more like, as we envision for our MOM event, somebody who's coming up for a short period of time to do pro bono work there. Specifically under the dental regulations, that's the only avenue available for a courtesy license. We don't have temporary licenses. We only have courtesy licenses. And one of the requirements for being issued a courtesy license is it's you can't earn anything under the license. You can be paid for travel, but you can't be you can't earn any remuneration for what you're doing.
Okay, excellent. Answered my question. Is there any other questions for Dave? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This looks like it'll be a really great event, and I am hopeful we can make this happen. I think some of my constituents would be interested in taking advantage of it, represent a lot of moderate to low-income folks who may not have great health care access. And my only concern is what would happen if there were a follow-up procedure or something? So for the type of dental work that's envisioned for this event, is it, you know, kind of what you would classify in the more simple kind of interaction where it's a cleaning and that type of thing? It wouldn't get into tooth extraction or something that could have a problem later, an infection or something, or how would those situations be addressed?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, what you say is partially the parts in play. I'm actually going to defer most of this question to Dr. Robinson, who's on a scheduled to be on the phone. She is one of our chairpersons for the MOM event and can speak more specifically to what the follow-up care will be and how we're going to handle moving patients through and what procedures will be done. I can say, though, that while we're looking to see 1,000 people during that two-day event, which is a lot of people, by the nature, some of the procedures will have to be limited in nature there, and certainly complicated surgeries and things of that nature, it's not the setting for them. Mm-hmm. People who have needs like that, we're going to work to try and find other avenues to get them the care they need.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Seen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When looking through these, the difference between the temporary and the courtesy permit, and then bringing up the military courtesy licenses, which is 08-01-063, the bill doesn't cover military courtesy licenses. Is there any reason why we wouldn't want to allow those doctors to perform these voluntary services and be covered as well, or be have immunity? I've just seen this in the last couple of minutes. Otherwise, I would have asked sooner, but. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Dave.
Representative Seaton, through the chair. I can't speak specifically for the other professions. I can tell you that through the dental board where our courtesy licenses would be issued, military dentists are eligible through courtesy licenses through our board. I have a feeling, without looking specifically at the one that you're quoting under central licensing, that it probably deals more for, or it's probably more intended for non-healthcare professions. I believe that all the other boards also have provisions in place for how they license folks who have military service, but I can't swear to that. I can only tell you from the dental end.
Okay. Are you good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If there is no other questions for Dr. Dave Logan, we will let you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And be prepared to come back. And online, we're going to open public testimony now for this bill, HB 269. And let's go online, and since Dr. Logan's already mentioned your name, Julie Robinson, are you online? Julie?
Yes, I am. Yes, this is Dr. Julie Robinson. I'm online.
Okay, you have the mic. Put your name on record for us and your affiliation.
My name is Dr. Julie Robinson. I'm with the Alaska Mission of Mercy and the Alaska Dental Society, and I am one of the co-chairs for the Alaska Mission of Mercy.
There was a question about follow-up care. Can you address that for us?
Yeah, let me give you real briefly where we are. I heard 187 dentists, and naturally we have 1,058 total volunteers and 202 dentists registered at this point. We have the benefit of being the 27th state to do a Mission of Mercy, so we have the benefit of following after many other events, and so there's a protocol in place for follow-up care. Now, so the first thing that I have to say is that in this type of mission setting, the scope of practice is limited. We will not be doing anything like molar root canals, complicated surgeries, extraction of unexposed wisdom teeth, and things of that nature. Our main goal in this Mission of Mercy is to eliminate pain and infection, and to restore some smiles and make some flippers so people can get jobs and smile and replace the anterior teeth. Now, when patients sign up, they are told from the very beginning that there's that the dentist that they're seeing may be from out of town or they may be from out of state. And they also see when they register on the back of the registration page, which they sign, is printed the immunity clause. And also when following up with that, when the treatment is done, they go through, as they're routed through the clinic and they say they have an extraction or a filling or a root canal on an anterior tooth, they go through the post-op section in which the dentist will sit down with them, look at the treatment they had, provide them with written instruction, you know, with post-op care, and on those written instructions will be a cell phone number that will be monitored by a dentist for the next 2 weeks. The Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center has agreed to see 10 people for no charge after the event, and the rest of the people will be seen by other dentists that on their registration have indicated that they would see a post-op patient. Now, typically, of the 2,000 people that are typically seen, like in an Oregon event, they have less than a half a dozen post-op calls. And those post-op calls are typically things like a bone spicule after a tooth was taken out, maybe a high spot on a filling, maybe an open contact with a filling. And most of these can be taken care of, you know, relatively easy in the dental office. So the dentists that have signed up, say, from out of town, and we have quite a few from all around the state that have signed up, and for dentists that are that have the courtesy license, on their registration it specifically asks if they're available to see post-op patients. And they will say no, because obviously if you're a military dentist, you're not going to be able to see, you know, somebody on a military base because they're not eligible. So the follow-up is pretty much covered.
One of the... go ahead. No, go ahead, Julie.
Okay, well, I also wanted to take that at this point, you know, of those 202 dentists that have signed up, we have 8 of them are either military or federal service dentists, and 9 of them are family, friends, or previous Mission of Mercy volunteers that have elected to come up to Alaska to help us. And the licenses are pretty much all across the United States. We have licenses from Nevada, Texas, North Dakota, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Nebraska, North Carolina, and California. And as Dave said, we hope to see about 2,000 of the underserved Alaskans in 2 days. Now, this is our first Mission of Mercy, and so we may not reach that goal, but, you know, it's good to have lofty goals, and we're trying to get as many volunteers in there so that we can see as many people as possible, because it's a rather expensive to ship the equipment up here. And Alaska has the, you know, more challenges than, you know, the contiguous 48 states in that, you know, our equipment is coming from Wichita, Kansas. It's going to be driven to Seattle, Washington, and then Total Motion Freight is bringing it up here. We'll set it up in the design center. Tote will take it back down, and then it goes on to Chico, California.
And
that's kind of the Mission Diversity in a nutshell, and we've got 56 days until showtime. And I would really like to see this courtesy license or the immunity extended to the courtesy license so that you feel like our people that are coming up and volunteering have the same immunity protection as the Denison State of Alaska. I mean, our main goal right now is to pull off this Mission Emergency in Anchorage. The long-term goal, like many other states, they have one of these a year, and they move it around from different cities to different cities. And in 2015, we would like to move it up to Fairbanks. And if we did it in Fairbanks, it would likely be in the summer, and it would probably, again, attract a lot of military dentists from the military bases up there, and, you know, perhaps some people from the lower 48 that have never, you know, been to Alaska, and they could combine a vacation with volunteering and helping out, you know, provide some pro bono dentistry for some underserved Alaskans.
Julie,
I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Julie, can you remind us of the dates again?
The setup is April 10th. Treatment days are 11th and 12th, and teardown is on the 13th. The doors will open at 4:30 a.m. in the morning, and that's so that the patients can come through registration, medical triage, dental triage, get necessary x-rays, and then by 6 o'clock in the morning is when we want all the treatment to start, and that's when all the oral surgery, restorative, hygiene departments all open, and then we will be treating patients until 6 p.m. that evening.
Now, Julie, one of the things that I would like to see during this event is the donut hole people, and what I mean by those people are the ones that are working, they're the working class, but yet don't have insurance and can't afford to go to the dentist. I really would like to see you guys make an effort to see those people, the Medicaid people. You know, we've got a pretty good coverage on them already, but we still, you know, obviously want to see everybody we can. But it's that working class individual that can't afford to go to the dentist, that just needs a filling done. They've been putting it off because they just can't afford that $200 right now because they're paying for fuel or whatever the case may be. I'd really like to see you guys make an effort and try to really bring in those people into your center at this time. So if you could do that, that would be great. I guess one other request on my behalf is that I'm in session. I'm a dentist. You'd have to talk to the speaker to get me out of session to come down. That might have to happen. So, but anyhow, I wish you great success on this. I think it's going to be really grateful for the state of Alaska and especially for the community. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you so much for those comments, because those are the folks, I think I represent quite a few of those folks, and really appreciate Dr. Robinson, that description that goes through how everything would be handled and alleviate some of my concerns, just in case there was a problem that arose later. And if this legislation is successful, you know, please let us know how we can help promote the event to our constituents, or, you know, get the word out and get folks to show up, so it's a great success.
Are there any other questions for Julie? Julie, thank you for your time. Well, let's move on with to Randy Sweet with the United Way of Anchorage. Are you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Randy Sweet, and I'm the Director of Health Impact with United Way of Anchorage. We're also a partner with Alaska Mission of Mercy. Thank you for this opportunity to testify in support of HB 269. So why is this important? The current Volunteer Healthcare Provider Immunity Act provides protection to Alaska healthcare providers who volunteer their time and talent to help vulnerable Alaskans. The need is great. The Anchorage Daily News recently reported that Alaskans are among the least insured in the nation. The Society of Actuaries and Insurance-Related Organizations said in a recent study that 20.6% of the state's population is without insurance, a proportion exceeded by only five other states. Hundreds of vulnerable Alaskans have benefited from donated health service. So what does this mean to Alaskans who receive this care? And I'm just going to give you some comments from individuals who received care at Alaska Care's UAA Dental Days free clinic. One person says, free dental work without insurance was a lifesaver. Another, as a mother of four, I appreciated the services provided. It's been an overall good experience. Thank you so much for taking the time to help one family. Another says, everyone was great, thank you, plus the new information on flossing and brushing habits. Here's a comment by a patient receiving care through Anchorage Project Access. I own a cleaning service and have been cleaning for 25 years. One night I was giving my hip and leg a good massage when I felt something go crunch. A few weeks later, I came home and collapsed into a bed, and that was the last time I walked on my own. I managed to end up at Orthopedic Physicians of Anchorage, where they told me that both hips needed replacing. I cried and left with another prescription for painkillers and a diagnosis that seemed impossible for me to deal with. I turned to Anchorage Project Access. Everyone there is kind. I received my new hips on September 10, 2012 at Regional Hospital from Dr. Timothy Cavanaugh. 2 months later, I can walk without a walker or a cane for the first time. The goal of climbing flat top next summer seems completely reasonable. I want to thank Anchorage Project Access with my whole heart. I didn't think I would ever walk again, but thanks to Anchorage Project Access, I am. God bless everyone involved. And also the volunteers, they enjoy utilizing their skills to help those in need, in this case of dental care, and it's great to interact with other professionals while performing a good cause. So I ask you to please build on the success of pro bono health care in our state and allow individuals, including our military, who come from other states and have an Alaska courtesy license to provide health care and to afford these individuals the protection given Alaska health care providers. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Emily? No. Thank you, Emily, for your time. Okay, with that, let's go to the audience in here. We have Emily, is it Ennis? Ennis, can you come forward and do you want to testify or?
Not for this one.
Oh, okay, you signed up for this one. That's okay. Not a problem. Are there any other questions for the sponsor? No? Well, with that then, what's the wishes of the committee? Are there any amendments? No? Then with that, is there a motion to move CS for HB 269 version 28 LS 1251-U with individual recommendation attached fiscal note from the committee?
So moved.
So moved. So hearing no objections, CS for HB 269 version 28 LS 1251-U moves out of the House Health and Social Service Committee. So we'll take a brief at ease. All right. Before us now is HB 281. If I could have the sponsors come forward and give their name and affiliations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill. My name is Representative Lynn Gaddis, and I represent the Greater Wasilla Area, District 9. So I'm afraid to say this, but I think it's a relatively simple bill, and I know but what HB 281 does is clarifies in statute that physicians may not be sanctioned for dispensing or administering prescription medications without a physical examination of the patient. This practice is called telemedicine. Telemedicine-based medical care would be delivered by primary care physicians within the state of Alaska. Anyone needing medical care would be a candidate for this system, but imagine the benefits for a working mother with a sick child. I got to tell you, I've been there before. A rural homesteader or an employee who cannot take time off work. Under HB 281, patients will be able to obtain over the phone and online consultations where physicians can diagnose an ailment and, if necessary, provide a prescription. This bill stipulates that physicians would not be able to prescribe controlled substances. Some benefits of telemedicine are certainly the convenience to patients. I think as our state of Alaska grows, as technology becomes a part of our everyday life, I think telemedicine, it's time for that to come to fruition. There's certainly an affordability. When time becomes money, if we're all working, sometimes some of us have to go to the ER to get seen. This keeps that from happening. Typically, it's about $40 an average consultation fee versus over $1,000 for the emergency room. I think we can see the savings right there. We have immediate access versus, and I'm sure none of you have waited in doctor's offices, certainly would not refer to dentists, of course, but no, seriously, in doctor's offices where time, again, is money. It's higher productivity for a healthier workforce. I got to tell you myself, sometimes I hold off from going to a doctor because I just don't have the time. I think I'll wait it out. I'll see what happens and sometimes that doesn't make me a healthier person. Primary care access for rural residents. And as we well know in this state, we do have a lot of folks that live in rural areas that don't have quick access to this kind of health care. The efficient quality of the system comes down to cost and access. Telemedicine does not replace a relationship with primary care provider. If a patient does not have a primary care provider, they may designate a telemedicine provider as their PCP, which is primary care provider. By requesting a consultation, a person is entering into a doctor-patient relationship. And as I went around to some of you and some of my other colleagues talking about this bill, I think one of the first things that they had a struggle trying to interpret in telemedicine is, remember when we go into a doctor's office, we go, probably one of the first things that we do is grab that clipboard and start filling it out and start updating and or telling our doctor whether we're allergic to this, whether we've had this problem or not. That doesn't go away with telemedicine. That just is done either in phone or online. So that same process happens. It's just done with technology. So I have my aide, Reed Harris, here to help answer questions, and we do have some folks in the audience ready to testify. So ready for questions.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just was hoping, because the supporting documents were from Teladoc, are we going to hear from maybe Alaska?
Mr. Chair, I did kind of give her thumbs up, and I didn't let her stop, so I'm not sure if she meant Teladoc or Alaska Physicians.
If I might, Mr. Chairman, just an Alaska-based organization or doctors. Yeah, that's what I was hoping to hear from, just from that perspective of the professionals.
And I don't have anybody lined up in that regards. I thought, excuse me, Mr. Chair, but I thought that it would be best hearing from folks that have done it in other states, mm-hmm. that understand the process and understand from a doctor's point of view kind of some of the limitations that we have right now. Mm-hmm. So that's why we thought to bring them forward.
And let me recognize Representative Nygak has joined us. He's been here for a few minutes. Okay. So.
You recognize me.
One of the, and I've had discussions with you guys on this, and you've kind of alluded to the fact that that the health history and the informed consent form is something that you expect physicians to do on the phone. It's not in your bill, though. You know, just basically your bill based. So are you assuming that's just going to happen, or?
Well, and I guess I'll go back to that doctor's visit that when I walk in, I certainly assume, and I don't like to assume, that the doctor is going to take all the relevant information that he needs to do, or she, to be able to give good service to me and back up their license. So, you know, again, I don't like to assume, but we're already making that, we're already, when we go to a doctor's office, asking that they do what they need to do to have their backup. So I don't see this making any difference.
And I would agree with you. I think that anyone within the medical profession should have the proper documentation before they would give out any kind of prescription or any kind of diagnosis to begin with. I mean, obviously, your license is worth a lot to you. You know, once again, and I don't like to micromanage people either, but, you know, sometimes we have to wonder whether or not that's something that, you know, needs to be put in or not. I don't know. We'll kind of discuss that as we move this along. Go ahead and put your name on the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Reed Harris, staff to Representative Gaddis. What you brought up there, and this is something we spoke about in your offices, the Alaska medical community is very tight-knit, and you were saying that if someone is doing something that's out of line, their license is pretty quickly going to be called into question. Obviously, it's in the best interest of doctors to continue with their licenses since it's a source of livelihood. I believe Section 3 of your bill where it says the person consents to sending a copy of all records of the person's encounter to the person's primary care provider. As far as medical histories go, I believe once they have established that, let me back up here. If you're using a telemedicine provider, if you do not have a primary care physician, you are then making that telemedicine provider your primary care physician. They're going to take all your information, and you'll basically say, okay, you are now my guy. If you're someone like myself, or probably most people in the room who already has a primary care provider, they're going to be sending that information off to your PCP already. So that information will go onto your file. I hope that answers your question.
Maybe. Representative Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill requires a physician to be in the state of Alaska. A number of people go out, are referred outside for treatment. Is there anything in this bill that then would, by requiring that the physician has to be in the state of Alaska, that the specialists or whoever you're dealing with will not be able to alter prescriptions for someone when they come back to the state of Alaska?
Through the chair. I think I understood your question. For starters, this does not discuss specialist or specialty care. Quite frankly, it touches upon people seeking consultation through telemedicine, respiratory illness, skin problems, abdominal pain, back and joint problems, some of the things that we find relatively common but not specialty care. So it does not address the specialty care aspect, and I'm not sure if my aide can add to that.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I have the wrong version. Are we on version A?
Correct.
Yes.
And where is the limitation on prescribing for those for respiratory tract infections or skin infections or something? I don't see it in the bill.
Through the chair, I think that what I spoke about, that it wasn't specific to that in the bill, but that's what telemedicine allows you to do. We didn't stop it there, but because the specialty items and out of state, it keeps that out of the bill. I mean, we didn't say that these are the only things that you can do, but these are the things in telemedicine. And I think now is probably a great time to bring a doctor up that when they discuss that, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
I have one more question.
Okay.
Okay. I know you're trying to get.
Yeah, I am.
Trying to get off.
You're on to me.
One more question.
Okay.
We're talking about health care forms, right? And basically you're citing Section 3 here of Section 1, Verse 3. A person consents to sending a copy of all records of the encounter to the person's primary care provider if the prescribing physician is not the person's primary care provider. So it's going to be who sends that? Is it going to be the person they call? Are they required to send that? And how would they know who to send it to?
Mr. Chair, the telemedicine provider would be required to send it to the to your primary care physician. What this bill does not address is the timeline that they do that in. I know, in speaking with some of the people that are in the industry here, it's instantaneous. As soon as you get off the phone or the connection with them, they immediately send your information to your primary care provider. If you designated one, if they are your primary care provider, they would retain that information.
Right. And just a follow-up on that, you know, Teladoc is here to speak with us, and they're a very good company, and I appreciate it. And we've talked about all these, and they have all this in place. But what happens if we're not using Teladoc? Because this opens us up to anybody that has a telephone. Okay, not just Teladoc. I mean, so it's, you know, it's across the board to everybody. So, and that's what we have to look at. We have to look at, you know, how does everybody use this, and how do we get information back across to people, and who's required to do that?
And Mr. Chair, if I might speak to that, I may have misheard, but I don't think it opens up the door to anybody with a telephone, but rather certainly a doctor with a telephone. And I'll give you that. You know, I'll meet you halfway there. I think that we also have the same situation when we walk in. When I walk into an instant care, I have a primary doc, and this actually happened last year right before session. Earache, instant care. They want to know who my primary doctor is. I consent to allow them to send it. Now, how do I know if they sent it or not? To tell you the truth, I don't know. But I did consent for them to send it, my records, a slight ear infection, to my primary doctor back in Wasilla. So we have that situation already in place with our doctors.
But when you went to that urgent care center, you filled out forms.
You're right. And if we do it online and fill out forms, we would be doing the same thing. And that's really all this bill does, is it allows us to do it online or have it done over the phone. It's the same process that we go to when we walk into a doctor's office and tell them our health history.
Okay. We'll let you off the hot seat now. Is there any questions? Representative Gannis? Representative Tarr?
I'm sorry to do this. I guess where I was going with that earlier question is I just had something from the Native Tribal Health Consortium about their AFCAN, which is their telemedicine program. And I guess what I was trying to understand is sort of like what's already happening in Alaska with telemedicine, and because I have some understanding that it's used in rural communities, mm-hmm. and then how this complements that.
I can feel that for you through the chair. Mm-hmm. AFCAN is a very interesting and very nice, I would say, program. It's a little bit different than telemedicine. What AFCAN does is there is actually a provider on the other end. There's someone, if you were the patient, per se, and I were the doctor, this other person would get with you and either call me on the phone or possibly have an internet connection. They also have this really neat cart with all these medical instruments on it. But there's someone there assisting you. With this, mm-hmm. It's just you, you're the patient.
Okay.
I've heard, I don't want to talk badly about the system, but complaints where people have been in remote areas, and they've been trying to use this system, and it's you talking to a person who's talking on a very scratchy connection to a doctor, mm-hmm. and that's possibly not as helpful. It might just be better that you as the patient spoke directly to myself as the doctor.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
All right, no more questions.
Well, and Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify one more time that this particular bill is a relatively simple bill, but that it clarifies in statute that physicians may not be sanctioned for dispensing or administering prescription medications without a physical examination of the patient. And quite frankly, that already happens right now, and I'm sure many of you have called up your doctor and told him the symptoms and told him your problems, and it's very possible that they said, sure, I know you. You are a patient of record. Based on your medical problem, it happens. Right now, this just clarifies and keeps them out of hot water.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. And another question, and it may be better answered by somebody else. I'm just getting the questions out there. So we talked a little bit about Native Health Service, but we have the VA, and sometimes those docs may not be in the state. So does this bill restrict so that the VA can no longer use doctors that are outside talking to a veteran, or somebody in the Indian Health Service can't be using a doctor outside.
I can answer that for you, Representative, through the chair. The VA, the military, the ANTHC, they have a federal exemption. I can't tell you, unfortunately, off the top of my head what that exemption is, but it allows them to operate as they are already, whereas an in-state doctor wanting to speak with possibly you, an in-state patient, cannot do that. It's not to say they cannot do that, but this is clarifying in statute that they can do that. There's been a difference of opinion between the board and doctors wanting to start engaging in the practice of telehealth, or a telehealth provider, such as someone who we're about to hear from in the committee. I hope that got your question.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, some things we're just trying to get on the record so that everyone that is listening to this across the state of Alaska has the answers to those same questions that some of us have. So thank you.
Okay. If there's no more further questions, we'll open it up to the public.
Thank you.
So, in the audience, since we've already brought up Teladoc, is Henry DePhillips, Dr. DePhillips, is he there? Come forward and give us your name and your affiliation, and we'll go from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Forgive me for being a little bit nervous today. This is not what I normally do. My name is Dr. Henry DePhillips. I'm the Corporate Chief Medical Officer for Teladoc. Teladoc is the oldest and largest telehealth company in the United States. I think my role in this proceeding is probably better served by being perceived as a subject matter expert in the telemedicine industry, and so I'll actually ask the group if I can make comments that are general to the industry, and if I answer a question that is specific to our company and does not necessarily apply to the rest of the industry, I'll indicate that specifically, if that's okay.
That's fine.
Thanks.
Well, you're asking for – tell us what Teladoc does.
I have a couple of things to say, or you can ask questions, whichever you prefer.
Tell us what you got to say.
Fair enough. Thanks for letting me be here. Telemedicine is it's an interesting topic. In a sense, telemedicine's been around for decades, because all of you probably see a physician who occasionally takes time off and signs out to another physician who offers to cover for your physician's patients. In that instance, you're going to call your doctor's office. Your doctor's going to be away, refer you to the other doctor. You're going to get the other doctor. That other doctor, using a telephone, or maybe these days a device that looks like this with a video capability, is going to talk to you long enough to understand what your medical issue is, make a diagnosis, and render treatment over the phone, and no prior in-person visit will have taken place. So the concept is not new. I think the naming is new. The business model is perhaps new, relatively new. The industry, our company is the oldest in the industry. We've been around for a dozen years, and it's taking off. About 15 million Americans are currently covered in a telemedicine program through their employer or through their health insurance company. Probably north in the industry, well north of about 500,000 consults of this form have taken place thus far across the 50 states. And to date, there has not been a liability issue at all. These programs have a couple of features that I think are important to note that are different from traditional cross-coverage that I just described. One is no DEA-controlled substances are allowed through the program, and that's an industry-wide price of entry, and I think a very good one. And I think that's important, that has made it a safe program in part. Number two, there is a limited number of diagnoses that telemedicine providers in primary care settings will typically treat. These are common, uncomplicated medical problems that typically don't have complications associated with them and are not complex to treat. These conditions are typically known by the person who gets them, like a recurrent urinary tract infection, a recurrent sinus infection, those sorts of things. The treatments tend to be fairly straightforward. The majority of the prescriptions through telemedicine are generic and fall into three classes, usually antibiotics like amoxicillin, anti-allergy medications, and maybe inhalers for respiratory illnesses. Those are examples. Telemedicine does not make the pharmaceutical industry any richer than it already is. A couple of important things. I think what got us to this table is the following scenario, and this is my sort of observation coming into the industry in the last year. Back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, a number of internet sort of scam offerings came up where you go online, fill out a questionnaire, you're given a prescription, typically for a DEA-controlled substance, and that's bad for everybody. The boards around the country, including the Alaska Board, imposed what's called the prior in-person visit requirement, which is what Representative Gaddis was referencing, that physical exam. And that did a pretty good job of putting those industries out of business. Quickly, people realized that in the cross-coverage situation I just described, that's a telephonic encounter without a prior in-person visit, and so some exceptions had to be passed at the regulatory level. So exceptions include a cross-coverage exemption, maybe if there's an emergency situation and care needs to be rendered or a life or limb will be threatened, that may be an exemption. There may be a Good Samaritan exemption, if you know, that sort of thing. The attorneys in our industry have taken a look at the regs and said, you know what, this really is truly a cross-coverage service, and therefore we're subject to the cross-coverage exemption. And most of the companies in my space, in our space, have operated under that sort of thought principle up until the boards intervene. The medical boards, the medical board in Alaska disagrees with that interpretation, and quite frankly, that's what got us here today. Prior to my coming to the industry, our company attempted to work with the medical board and just could not get to resolution on that issue. They sort of dug their heels in. So we've started the process industry-wide of seeking a legislative solution, which is what really got us here today. I think that the concern on the part of the medical board, and I'm not speaking on their behalf, and I'm not authorized to speak on their behalf, but I think the concern that I hear at this board and a couple of others is they're concerned that the care of the citizens of Alaska will go to doctors that are not in Alaska, that are elsewhere. And I think at least, and this is company-specific, our business model calls for the care of the citizens of Alaska to occur with physicians who are licensed and live in and work in the state of Alaska. So our model, I think, addresses that well. The second perception is that if you have a prior in-person physical exam, that somehow the quality of care is compromised. The data would actually argue differently at this point. For common uncomplicated medical problems in the model I described, well over 500,000 consults have been done, and there have been no liability issues. The telemedicine companies typically cover the liability insurance for the docs who do the consults. The premiums are at the lowest levels, class one, if you will, and there have not been any claims made, at least in our company's experience. So I think the data would argue otherwise. And we also talked about the fact, and Representative Gaddis referenced the fact earlier, that telephonic diagnosis and treatment has occurred for decades in a cross-coverage situation. This is, quite frankly, not that different. The last piece of sort of validating evidence, and then I'll get to the two issues that have been raised. The RAND Corporation, a very reputable company, has done a study in telemedicine. Happened to be a population we covered, but we had nothing, our company had nothing to do with the study. It was published last week, journal called Health Affairs, very credible medical journal. For those of you who don't have a copy, be glad to email you a copy. It's worth a read. There were three take-home points. Number one is, we estimated that folks who didn't have telemedicine available as an option would seek emergency room care for a non-emergency problem 8% of the time. The RAND Corporation demonstrated that the actual number is 25% of the time. That was in a California population. I suspect in Alaska that number might be somewhat higher. The second thing that the RAND Corporation concluded was that telemedicine is of particular value to people who have a medical problem who don't have an established relationship with a primary care physician. It was found to be particularly helpful in that scenario, and I think it could be helpful here in the state. And the third is that based on one and two, it's not a big stretch to deduce that the cost of medical care is reduced when a telemedicine program is introduced. We've got some data, and the industry has data that can demonstrate that very well. There's an upcoming paper that will be published again. Our company had nothing to do with it in about 2 months, that I'll be glad to share with the group. Of course, it'll be later than today. But I think that we're finally getting some good data on telemedicine. Access, cost are improved. Those are two issues in Alaska. And really what we're trying to get at with this bill is just the opportunity to make it so that the medical board sort of doesn't intervene in the process of telemedicine and allow it to go forward in the safe manner that's been demonstrated to date. Representative to my right asked about local Alaska physicians. I will say that the group that we have assembled here in Alaska, have worked with the Alaska State Medical Association, met with them a couple of times, and the language that you see in Representative Gaddis's bill is by mutual agreement with the ASMA. I can't speak on their behalf or for them. I'm not authorized, but that is an agreement that we came to in preparation for today. So I wanted to make sure that you understood that. As far as the representative to my left, I think, asked about, or maybe you did, Mr. Chairman, about requiring the medical history being filled out. I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is telemedicine needs to be watched. It needs to be overseen. There needs to be some structure to it. But I would highly recommend that the group not try to apply a different standard to a telemedicine counter than is applied in the in-person setting. So in the in-person setting, I don't think there's a legal requirement or even a regulatory requirement that if you're not the patient's PCP that you send a copy of the record to the PCP. I don't think there's a requirement that you fill out the clipboard. It's just good medical practice to do so. It's good medical practice to send the encounter to the patient's PCP. It happens all the time already. I'm not so sure legislation is needed to make those things happen in a telemedicine environment. So thank you for allowing me to speak probably for too long.
No, you did great. You did great. And with that said, though, there is a standard of care.
Yes.
That we are held responsible to.
That is true.
And the standard of care is basically we take an intake form mm-hmm. and consent form, health history, mm-hmm. and so forth. So even though it's not written, it is a standard of care.
That is correct.
And if you find yourself outside that standard of care, you are in trouble.
I would agree. I think that sort of what overrides the entire practice of medicine, regardless of what the modality is the standard of care, and that will be applied and should be applied in all settings.
Exactly, and that's why I said earlier, you know, we've had discussions on it. I think that if anyone's going to do this and doesn't do some sort of a form, well, shame on them.
Yeah, so. You really haven't established a relationship with the patient that's at the standard of care.
That's correct, and you know, the other, you know, telemedicine is it's something that we need to look at as a committee, as a state, because the savings it could actually give us in the Medicaid field is really something that we need to take a really close look at. Native corporations are doing telemedicine now, mm-hmm. and they've been doing it for years, mm-hmm. and it's working. And yes. So in the public sector, we should be able to do the same thing.
Correct.
Too. And I can see the cost savings that would happen.
Yes.
And so I appreciate this bill coming forward so that we can talk about it.
Yes.
And if there's any questions for Dr. Representative Tarr?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to understand the 3 points you brought up from this health affairs article, the one that it was particularly helpful when you didn't have a primary care provider, and that's a topic we've been discussing related to budgetary issues the last couple weeks and how many people are repeat emergency room users rather than having a PCP. Mm-hmm. And so for those folks, just what I was thinking is the reason they're going to an emergency room is, you know, they just don't know what their other option is, basically, if they don't have care. How did they learn about this telemedicine option so they're diverted from the emergency room into this, you know, using telemedicine?
It's a very good question. I think in the future you'll see some direct-to-consumer telemedicine. There's some startup companies that are starting to go there. That market is not mature. So the majority of telemedicine in the industry is what we call a sponsored program. Your employer can purchase it, and then it's communicated to all the employees. There are a lot of national accounts that have employees here, like Home Depot and AT&T and Shell Oil. So telemedicine is already among those employees. If a health plan purchases it, then the entire membership of the health plan, if the health plan decides, is communicated in that way. We do, actually, our company, and this is now company-specific information, we have about 1.5 to 1.7 million Medicaid lives throughout the 50 states, and so through the Medicaid program, we'll communicate out. Sometimes it's text messaging. About 60% of Medicaid recipients have a cell phone mm-hmm. in most states, and I think Alaska's in that number. And so we'll communicate. So however we have to get the information to them, that the opportunity is there for them to have an alternative through the phone instead of using the emergency room, mm-hmm. we'll do it. And that's the beauty of a sponsored program, is you're partnering with the entity that's responsible for the care of that person.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. So on the Medicaid piece, would this bill allow that to be for us to be letting Medicaid recipients in Alaska know about telemedicine? We would need to do another change, I think, to make that available here.
So I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is that what this bill allows is the physicians in the state of Alaska to enroll in a telemedicine program if they choose to mm-hmm. and be compensated for doing that mm-hmm. Among the Alaskan citizens that are not already in a federal program. Under the federal programs, the VA and the Indian Health Service, telemedicine already happens today, but because it's regulated at the federal level, the medical board here has no jurisdiction over that practice. So what this does is it allows the folks in Alaska who are not in a federal program to have the same opportunity for a telemedicine benefit. If this bill were to pass, which I hope it does, then the Medicaid program here has already asked to come and speak with us about the possibility of adding this benefit to the Medicaid package in the state of Alaska. I think it's a great idea. I think there's opportunity for cost savings and improved access mm-hmm. here in the state of Alaska, particularly because of your geographic mm-hmm. expanse. Mm-hmm. By the way, I've gotten to enjoy your state personally, and I really enjoy it. my brother-in-law has lived here for 15 years as an ER doc in Anchorage. But Yeah, so the Medicaid folks have already approached us, but we need to take care of this first so that we can recruit a network. What we're really looking for is regulatory cover to recruit the physicians in Alaska so that they feel comfortable their license is not going to be in jeopardy if they enroll in something like this.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Can you explain to the committee just how it works? I mean, is there a central number, an 800 number you call? And
yeah, sure. Glad to do that, and thank you for asking. I probably should have done that sooner. So there's really two parts to a telemedicine consult in the primary, in the sponsored primary care model, and this is now industry-wide. You can either pick up the phone and talk to a customer service intake representative, and they will go through the medical history process and gather all the appropriate information, or you can go online and do the exact same thing. The information is identical no matter which of those vehicles you use. During the request process, it's important to know where you're calling from so you know which licensed physician needs to respond to that request, and also the age of the patient so you know which specialty to give it to, pediatrics versus, I think you get that. Part two is that the physician receives the consult request, reviews the information, which, by the way, the beauty of a telemedicine platform is that you can require the patient to fill out the medical history before they're given access to the doctor. And you can also require the doctor to review the medical history before they're given access to the patient. So unlike a traditional on-call where you just pick up the phone and call and do whatever, there's actually systems requirements that need to be met that help, the integrity of the program. Part two is that the doctor contacts the patient directly, again, usually telephone, audio, video. The audio, video, just so you know, it can't be Skype. It has to be a HIPAA-compliant, secure platform. And so they're all proprietary, built inside the network. Ours is. And the other companies that are in our space have a similar situation. The physician communicates real-time with the patient for as long as it takes for them to come to either a conclusion about what the patient has in a treatment plan or potentially to come to the conclusion that, you know what, there's something about this that makes me uncomfortable. I think you're better served by seeing a doc in person. I'm nervous about what might happen here if we try to treat you remotely. About 4% of the time, industry-wide, that's what happens. The patient is referred to an in-person setting. There's no incentives for the doc one way or the other to make that referral. They're not incentivized financially. They're paid regardless of what the outcome of the consult is. And I think all the companies would share this. We hire highly trained, highly qualified, experienced physicians, and then we empower them to make the decision at the end of the day about what's best for that patient. And if what's best for the patient is not to be cared for through a remote platform, then that's fine. That's appropriate, and that's where the safety valve sort of resides.
Paula?
So I guess I'm trying to let's say you're in Anchorage and you mm-hmm. give a call to the 800 number,
mm-hmm.
And you're assigned a doc.
Correct.
And then a week later, you need to follow up. You call up. Are you going to get that same doc?
So this is an area where our model is different than some of the competitors, so I'll answer separately if that's okay. Teladoc has felt very strongly that we don't want to get in the way of any existing primary care physician relationship. And one way to do that is to not put pictures or bios or even allow you to choose the doc that you get. It's a cross-coverage scenario, so just like when you walk into an emergency room or an urgent care center, you don't get to pick the doc. You're going to wind up with the doc that's working that day. That's kind of our philosophical approach. Some of our competitors do allow you to select a physician, so if you find one you like, you get to ask for them again. We don't offer that. Some of our competitors do. Our opinion is that creates a little bit of an emotional attachment, and to me, in our company's opinion, that's the beginning of really getting in the way of your existing primary care physician relationship. So,
follow up?
Thank you. So I guess I'm a little concerned on page one of the bill, line 10, it says, a physician is located in the state and available to provide follow-up care. So if you call in and you get a different doc, how was the doc satisfying this that doc is available for follow-up care with that patient?
Okay. It's a good question. There's sort of two parts of your question I'd like to comment on. And if I don't hit it right on, feel free to ask it a second time. Part one is, I think most of the companies in the industry do this, we certainly do, is there's a 72-hour window after the consult where you can get back in touch with the doc or the doc can get back in touch with the patient. So in other words, the doc can actually send a note out the next day securely, says, you know, you're feeling better, things going in the right direction, or the patient can say, hey, you know, it's 24 hours later and this is now happening, or I forgot to tell you that. So most of the companies have some kind of ability to stay in communication with the telemedicine physician for a period of time, limited, following the consult. That's number one. I haven't asked Representative Gaddis specifically about this particular component, but I think that the physician being located in the state of Alaska and being able to provide follow-up care is that they're resident here, they're licensed here, they're working here, and if the geography is right, they could the patient could actually get to the doc or get back to the doc if need be. I will tell you, in telemedicine, the industry so far has been designed to get people over the acute problem when they can't get to their own PCP and then get them back in touch with their primary care physician. Sorry, I keep using PCP, primary care physician, as soon as possible. So most of the telemedicine companies, ours included and the others, really try not to hang on to the patient, if you will. But I think that the legislation sort of wants to put a little bit of a backstop and a safety valve there, and we're very comfortable with this. We think this fits in the model, specifically because we have resident licensed physicians here in Alaska.
Follow up.
Okay.
And I guess I understand the in the state, because otherwise you have no sanctionability because you don't control the license of the physician. I'm just trying to prevent any problems down the line here.
Understood.
And is available for follow-up, to provide follow-up care. I'm concerned that, you know, oftentimes what we're trying to do is work with a group of docs, and you're not, well, like you said, you come in a week later and you're going to get assigned somebody else.
Right.
And so I want to make sure that as we write this bill, we don't have something in here that is putting the teledoc in what, not your company's specific name, but the telemedicine doctor having certified that he's available for care, and now the patient can't get to that person anymore because they get somebody else. So I don't know quite how to address that, Mr. Chairman, but I think that the wording might need to be such that follow-up care is provided through the telemedicine group or something, because I don't think that the model is necessarily going to be the same doc, and that's a concern because that doctor is now the primary care physician for many of these people that are going to be calling in, because it says right down below that you're going to give it to somebody else as a primary care. If not, you are then their primary care doc. But it's really like my clinic that I go to. I go to any one of the doctors that they're at the clinic, but that's not what this says. And so I think that we need to somehow address this line, available to provide follow-up care, as in the situation that's probably really going to be, and that there's a group of doctors that are in the system, and anyone in that group will do the follow-up care, and that the physician who's providing this prescription is not certifying something that the person can't even get back to them because they don't even maybe even know the name, they haven't seen the picture, or those kind of things.
May I comment?
Go ahead.
Thank you. So again, I would come back to I would look at the telemedicine service and the industry as a physician cross-coverage service, and it's basically a large group, right? So all the companies, including our competitors, have 24/7, 365 coverage, and if this doc goes off, then another one's on. No different than a coverage group that's an that's physically here in Juneau. I guess I would come back to, you know, simplicity is a beautiful thing. So I wouldn't recommend not overcomplicating it. But the other thing is, I wouldn't put any burden on the telemedicine industry that you wouldn't put on an in-person visit industry, if you will. So if you go to your doc in person and you need to go back a couple days later, you're either going to see your doc, or if he or she is off, you're going to see one of the other docs in the group. No different with a telemedicine situation. This stipulates that the docs have to be licensed and resident in the state, and I think that's a good thing. I'm fine with that, and I think the industry is going to be fine with that. But if you need follow-up care back to this group, then it's either going to be the doc that took care of you, and some of our competitors do that, or it's going to be one of the other docs that's just as qualified as the doc that you saw and has access, by the way, to the medical record from the previous visit through the platform.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm uncomfortable with that, but we don't have a statute that says that that a doctor that gives a prescription has to be available for follow-up care. And here we're having a a statute that says that that doctor, that physician that does a telemedicine prescription, basically certifying that he is available for the follow-up care, and I don't believe that's the situation. So
I think, you know, I'll interrupt you for a second. I think we get your point, and basically, maybe on line two, it should basically say the physician is located in the state and leave it at that.
Leave it at that. Yeah, that might be simpler.
Yeah, because then we're keeping to the standard that we all are under right now, all the physicians in the state. Like you were saying, let's not add an undue, regulation on them.
And if it is something that we want to go to, Mr. Chairman, that says the group or that organization is available for follow-up care, I don't have a problem there. I think that we're specifying something on here that the physician is not going to be able to satisfy, but he is required to be there for the follow-up care, and I don't think we want to do that. So however we solve that, I'm just raising the issue at this hearing.
Okay. Are there any other questions for
you? Can I just comment on that? Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. Paul's right, except for I would be interested, and I don't know if we can make this happen. I'd be interested to see, and I can't see who the drafter was, why they put that and available to provide follow-up care. Mm-hmm. Because available just may mean that they need to be available, and we're good. So before we cut it, I would want to see what was their intent in putting it there. I agree. I don't want to put the burden back on the teledoc, the telemedicine people, and this could really go sideways quickly. But I'm not yet sure that I would want to necessarily cut that out. Does available just mean that they have to be available in Alaska? They have to be practicing. I mean, I'd be interested to see why they determined that piece right there was necessary.
So
can I make a brief suggestion?
Okay, brief.
The language in these three components was drafted collaboratively with the Alaska State Medical Association, and I believe one of the representatives of that association is at least in the building, if not in the room. I can't see behind me. Okay. And so it might be instructive to have a very brief recess, have a brief conversation, come back to the microphone. I'm just giving it to you as an option.
Nope. Valid.
Let's take a brief at ease for a minute. Brief at ease. And just so you know, the intention of the committee is to probably hold this bill over for one more hearing, so that we can kind of hammer out a little bit of the issues. So, you said you wanted to do a follow up.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, and thank you.
Let's try to keep it brief because we have a presentation that okay. We'd like to hear.
Thank you for the opportunity to break for a moment and have a sidebar conversation with the representative from the Alaska State Medical Association. So as I suspected, the reason why the available for follow-up care provision is present is so that once the consultation takes place, no different than a bricks and mortar visit, you have some opportunity to get back into medical attention if there's a problem of any kind, whether it's recontacting the telemedicine provider or whether it's recontacting your doc or your doc's coverage or your doc's partners. It's basically similar across the spectrum. So that was the intent of that, the follow-up care clause. And I think the recommendation of the collective group I just spoke to is to attempt to leave that in, if that's okay.
Right. Well, and as we discussed in the committee, I think what we would like on the next hearing, we'd like to see the drafter of the bill come in, and we also wanted to hear a little bit from the Medical Association and the Medical Board, too, with that. So that way we can hear all opinions. Representative
Seeger? Just to raise one other question to be answered in the next hearing. This says physician. And I'm wanting to make sure that whether we're having this so that anybody that has prescriptive abilities in the state of Alaska is not precluded. So it would be bad if we had a physician's office and there's a PA or somebody else if they have prescriptive ability and you call and you couldn't deal with the person, the same level of person you would deal there. So I don't know where that's at, and I don't know the status of the law, but I just want to raise it for the next hearing right. So it can be answered.
Well, Dr. DePhillips, we appreciate your testimony, and I know you're from Tennessee.
That is correct.
So I'm not sure if you're going to make it back up for the second hearing or not.
Or I may get stuck here between now and the next hearing.
Right. But we appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for allowing me.
Emily Enos, I know that you've been waiting patiently, so we appreciate your patience. And as every bill, as it starts to morph and we talk about it, as you can see, we've taken a little bit more time than we anticipated. But go ahead. Let's hear your testimony.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Emily Enos. I'm Executive Director of Fairbanks Resource Agency in Fairbanks, Alaska. And I'm here to speak to you about assisted living services in the state of Alaska for our seniors.
No, hold on.
Yes.
You're supposed to talk about prescriptions without physical examinations. We're not ready for your presentation yet. You keep signing up for the wrong paperwork. We are going to get to your presentation.
Sorry. I thought I'd taken my name off that one.
I'm sorry. It's probably our mistake.
We'll have to wait a little bit longer. I do
just
apologize.
Give me five more minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. We will hear from you, though.
Last time, but thank you.
Okay. Okay. With that, at this point, then, I think we're going to go ahead and we'll leave public testimony open for the bill. And we'll basically put the table, not table, but we're going to put the bill aside and we'll hear it again. So that's all I think we need to do, right? At this point? Okay. All right, we're good. Okay, now, Emily, let's bring you up.
Oh, nothing like starting off.
There we go.
Right there.
That must be Emily.
This is Emily. Emily.
I really am. Emily Ennis. Again.
And she's here to talk about Family Resource Agency.
Emily Ennis, okay. Executive Director of Fairbanks Resource Agency in Fairbanks. And I am here, finally, to talk about assisted living services for our seniors, not just in Fairbanks, but around the state of Alaska. And my presentation today will cover two points. One, I am going to give you some information about assisted living services. I know most of you do know what assisted living services are, and I've probably already heard many times over about the need in Alaska. And secondly, I'm going to talk about a project in Fairbanks that I have been working on with my agency and a team of consultants for over 2 years now, which we believe offers a solution for Alaska in terms of addressing the need for our seniors. So let's get started.
Now, Emily, in due time, we only have 30 minutes.
And I know, and I will move along quickly and also hopefully allow some time for discussion and questions. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief background. My agency, Fairbanks Resource Agency, has been around in our state for 45 years, serving seniors since the late 1980s. Primarily, our service delivery system is for individuals with developmental disabilities, but our community needed someone to step up for its seniors a number of years ago, so currently we provide support to over 250 seniors in the Fairbanks area. Over the last 10 years, we've noted the need for an assisted living services. We have a small number of what we refer to as mom and pops, and then, of course, our wonderful Pioneers Home. So we, about 10 years ago, started looking at what we could do for our seniors. Residents, options outside the family home, and found a lot of roadblocks when we started to think about assisted living. However, we did, in the meantime, develop quite an array of out-of-home services for seniors, so that when a family was beginning to recognize the need for care for their loved one, their adult parent, or spouse who could not live as independently as possible, the agency began responding for a list of services. And I put these up here because I want you to know, as we address this huge population of seniors needing care who can no longer live on their own, that these options should not be neglected, that the in-home services that we are offering around our state need to be expanded as well as assisted living to address the needs. So just a quick rundown, care coordination, a service that helps families put the pieces together for their senior or loved one, whether that's finding an assisted living home or services that can come in the home to help them. Respite care gives those families a break. I would like you to know that in our country, as well as in Alaska, 75% of elder care is done by the family. We are keeping seniors at home. There really aren't many options. And in Alaska, that's definitely happening as well. And it's a good thing because it is a more cost-effective and option. And definitely most seniors want to stay with their families. Adult day center is another out-of-home option, but helps families care for a senior who's no longer independent. Chore services will go into a senior's home and provide help chopping wood, hauling water, getting groceries, picking up medications. Family caregiver services. This is a national program. Some of the agencies around the state have this program, looking at the needs of that family caregiver. Although families often want to provide this long-term care, there are difficulties as time goes on. Often a family just wears out. So the more we can do to sustain that care in the family home, the better off we'll all be in terms of preventing premature out-of-home placement. The last senior outreach is a really novel program that I'd like to briefly tell you about. We have trainers that go into local businesses that help the employees of that business, like a bank, a hair salon, a grocery store, recognize when a senior they've known for years is beginning to diminish in their abilities to function well. And they can help identify that and refer that senior to needed care. And lastly, assisted living. Definitely something we're trying to solve today. Where will our seniors, when they can no longer live in a family home, go? Many of them today are going out of state. The Fairbanks Memorial Hospital recently cited some figures that they have been keeping since last March. When a senior goes into the hospital in Fairbanks because of an acute care condition, often when they're ready to go home, the hospital does not feel it's safe to discharge. They are experiencing this event 2 to 3 times a week in Fairbanks. And they're having to look for an out-of-home, out-of-town placement for that senior in an assisted living home somewhere else in the state. Now, not only is this a difficult situation for the senior, it's a costly event for the hospital, as that senior may wait there in acute care bed for days or weeks until an out-of-town placement is located. And then that senior is sent to Anchorage or somewhere else where they're separated from family or friends. But more than that, that senior is stuck with the bill for those acute care days that are not covered by insurance. Often the hospital cannot collect that. So again, 3 times a week, 12 times a month on the average, that's occurring at a great cost to our hospital. So what are the options when a senior has to leave their home? You all probably are aware that independent senior housing is available around our state. In Fairbanks, we have something called Raven Landing. We also have South Hall Manor. I'm sure in Anchorage, Wasilla, and other areas, you'll have some senior housing. The main difference here is there are no services if a senior starts to decline. You're on your own. You're living independently. You have the help of other folks in the residence. Nursing homes, we often think, well, as we age or our family members age, a nursing home will be an option. We need to remember that a nursing home provides skilled nursing care. Most individuals who are elderly, growing frail, or disabled with Alzheimer's or dementia are not going to need the services of skilled nursing care. What they're going to be best served by or qualified, eligible for, will be assisted living. And assisted living will provide those supports for the activities of daily living that help a senior stay healthy and being able to enjoy a quality of life. And, of course, our Pioneer Home is our primary example of assisted living in our state and a high-quality model as well, I want to let you know.
And just to interrupt you real quick, on the Pioneer Home, just so everybody in the committee knows, is a 6-year waiting list.
Absolutely.
To get in.
So. Yes. Yes, and another interesting fact is in Fairbanks, the average age of folks going into our Pioneer Home after that 5 to 8 year wait in some cases is 85 years old. So folks are going into the Pine Miner home at a much older age than we would consider. Assisted living, another few key points I'd like to let you know about assisted living services is we like to see it, and most likely and most commonly it is in an adult home-like setting. So not necessarily a large institutional setting. There are full-time round-the-clock support, assistance, as I said, with ADL, that's dressing and bathing, meals, nutrition, medication assistance, hopefully some help with physical activities, staying in shape, perhaps even improving one's physical condition, an opportunity to socialize, perhaps even go out into the community, but definitely have social recreation activities in the facility. And most importantly, the chance to age in place. When you move into an assisted living home, you hopefully will see that as your last place of residence. Generally today in Alaska and around our country, seniors are moving into these facilities in what we refer to as level 2 or 3. They're not living independently at all. They are needing quite a bit of help. The average time spent in assisted living home is 18 months. I'd like to point out one major consideration as we look at developing assisted living homes in Alaska, that we need to make sure that in addition to the supports that our seniors get, that we help them avoid the three sins of aging. And those are helplessness, boredom, and loneliness. So it's very important as we look to the development of assisted living that we are providing opportunities for novelty in their lives, a chance to still experience a developmental, because aging is not just a condition that we have to face, but it's also another developmental stage in age in life. And we need to make the best of it. We need to be sure that we can provide a quality of life for our loved ones. The Pioneer Home is an excellent example of a philosophy and a nationally recognized, internationally recognized model called the Eden Alternative, which does encourage continued growth and development, participation, and activities. Dr. William Thomas, who developed the Eden Alternative, went on to develop a second model called the Greenhouse. And our project that we are developing in Fairbanks is replicating not only the Eden Alternative, but also the Greenhouse model. And this is a physical design which allows the development of home-like modules, 6 to 10 beds within a home. Now, three homes might be combined together, or even more, but the whole idea is the individual has a sense of a home and identity within a facility. So an important aspect that we want to replicate in Fairbanks. I'm sure many of you have, yes.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Just on this point, I was just going to ask, because I'm not sure if other committee members may have known the previous slide. This summer we had a admin reg review hearing about some new regulations that were going to be implemented related to payment for assisted living homes, and it was going to really hurt folks because it was going to, you know, basically be a lower reimbursement rate, and then they moved away from that. But just a brief update on that would be great.
Right. There was a proposed reduction in the Medicaid waiver rate paid for assisted living that has been put on hold for further study.
Okay.
To everyone's relief. But there is still some concern about that, the rate being far too low to sustain positive operating budgets.
Thank you.
We had previously entitled these slides the Grim Facts, but we were probably trying to be a little humorous. But our senior population facts in Alaska are startling. You've heard four times the rate of growth of the rest of the country. We definitely find that. I heard the other day that the Mat-Su Valley is experiencing growth five times the rate of our country. We certainly feel in Fairbanks that we are experiencing significant growth, particularly in the ages 75 and above. And I think we want to recognize that once you reach 75 and 85, your chance of experiencing Alzheimer's disease is 1 in 2. So we have an older population in our state, which is a good thing. There must be a reason people are living longer. But their chance of experiencing dementia increases significantly once you reach those older ages. Additional regional data is also compelling. And why do we have this growth? Why, you know, the demographics, the baby boom certainly explains some of this, but that's not the only reason we're seeing such a tremendous growth of our senior population. For the Fairbanks area, we believe people are choosing to remain in Fairbanks. When I moved there in 1974, people even began at that point to ask me, well, where will you retire? Where will you go after your time in Fairbanks? Well, that question isn't asked so frequently anymore. Fairbanks is a good place to live. In fact, Alaska in general is a good place to live. And our seniors have decided it's better to stay here. They want to stay here. Yes, Mr. Chair.
So apparently the Gulf Coast region is not a good place because it drops off here after 2020.
Yes.
Why is that?
Well, there's just some leveling out. This is just the projections the Department of Labor is sharing with us. I'm sorry, I can't explain that, but it does level off. In fact, we expect to see some leveling off and then declining by 2030.
Okay. I was just curious.
Well, I'll see if I can get some more information for you, Mr. Chair. But in addition to people deciding to stay in Alaska and not going south, not even for the winters as much anymore, we have improved health care. We have we've expanded our specialized medicine, so heart centers, et cetera, that are keeping folks here. Rural health care is definitely increased and improved. People are growing older, being healthy. And lastly, we're importing our seniors. We have the folks, our adults that are staying here, are bringing their parents here, and that is an unexpected cause, but definitely it is contributing to our senior population. So I wanted to tell you just a little bit about our project in Fairbanks. In your handouts, you do have a flyer that looks like this. You can see our concept design. There are quite a few bullet points to talk about our project. On the reverse page of this, a little glossy sheet, you can see our design, which describes the three in our 30-bed facility. There are three homes, as we've described them in the Green Project.
We'll get that passed out to the committee.
I'll wait a few minutes to go over that. But I just want to say this project we strongly feel is replicable around the state. It may be made a little smaller. It can be made bigger. But the key point is we believe this is a sustainable model operationally. We've started here in Fairbanks to address the need because, as you can see, a little over a year ago, I was involved in a survey to determine how many seniors at that period in time, last December 2012, said that they could use assisted living today. Now, this includes the Pioneer Home waiting list, and it includes surveys that we completed in the community for people who had not put their name on the Pioneer Home list for Fairbanks. At that time, around 1,100 seniors or their families indicated they could use assisted living today. With using that as projections, we're looking at within about 6 years, that number is nearly going to double. And the other survey we did, and we've updated it since, is really looked at the number of assisted living beds available in Fairbanks. So today we lead about 1,100 beds, 2020, 2,000. We have currently today 182. Big gap. Now remember, families are caring for many of these 1,100 folks in their home, and so that's helping a great deal. But how in the world are we going to close this gap? And this is a gap that doesn't just exist in Fairbanks, but all over our state, in rural and urban areas. The Pioneers Home is full. We did have, with some excitement, the opening of two new assisted living homes, small though they are. However, they are exclusively private pay, and that's where we get to the issue of the reimbursement rate for assisted living. There's a significant difference between what private pay can bring in at about $7,000 a month and the reimbursable rate under the Medicaid waiver, which is a little under $4,000. So as new individuals and small businesses are opening up assisted living, they are looking to private pay because they feel they can't put a pencil to it with if they're depending on the rate. Let's see. So why haven't we seen the commercial development that has occurred in the lower 48? Why have not some of those companies, the Marriott, et cetera, come up to Alaska to open assisted living homes? Well, in our 2 years of development, we found a number of reasons. Of course, the most important one, and I think the one that is most discouraging to developers, is that there are economic risks. High cost of building, cost of land. And it's always important to consider these residences and facilities need to be close to hospitals, so you're often finding them centrally located, and of course that's often the more expensive land to be found. We hear from developers that workforce shortages in Alaska for healthcare is a concern for them. Where are they going to get the workers they need to provide the care? And definitely that the reimbursement rates are considered inadequate. That you put a pencil to the operating budget, and if you're operating a home that with a high percentage of individuals who are low income, who are relying on Medicaid waiver rates or other public assistance, that they simply cannot make it work. And so the need for a very careful mix of that payer mix is going to be essential for the success. So over the last 2.5 years, our agency has been developing a pilot project that we feel is sustainable budget-wise, that would, with the help of the state, investing in some of the startup costs, that we could provide these services without coming back for further subsidy or support down the road. The biggest concern, as we've looked at budgets from different perspectives, is once you are responsible also for the development of the cost of land, cost of construction, that, you know, that debt service puts such a burden on the operating cost. If you're looking to serve individuals who use Medicaid waivers and state reimbursement, that there's no way to keep the doors open. So the need for assistance with those development costs is essential, we believe, in providing these options around our state. You know, it's so we're approaching this as an answer to the state's interest in the public-private partnership with assistance at the beginning up front, and then we'll take over from there. We do believe other communities will have nonprofit organizations who would also step up if a model like this can be replicated. Of course, assisted living brings a new business to a community, brings new jobs. There are some facts that show the economic boost, and we can provide those to you at a later date if you'd like. The purchasing power in a community, and of course, the biggest value, our seniors get to remain at home with their families, and families don't have to ship them out of state, is what's happening in many cases, or be separated. So I've provided not only the sheet which provides the design concept and the financial plan, but also a fact sheet, frequently asked questions. We've been meeting with folks around our community, the Interior Delegation, Deputy Commissioner, the head of the Pioneer Home, over the last number of months. And we've had a lot of questions that have been presented. So the question and answer sheet represents most of the questions that have been posed to us over the last 6 months. And lastly, this quote, I have to thank Rosalind Carter for it, but I felt as I've worked on this project for the last 2 years. This really, I think, articulates the condition we are in here in Alaska. We are approaching a crisis in terms of care for our seniors. The numbers are staggering. The waiting lists are exceptionally high. The length of time to find this care in our community is really unforgivable in terms of the needs of families and our seniors. If we don't start today, I'm not sure how we're going to be able to address it. So I appreciate the time to share this with you, and there are a few minutes. I'll be happy to answer questions. The one thing I would like before I close, Mr. Chairman, is just to point out on the fact sheet, particularly the item number one. We did a comparison a couple of months ago with the help of the Fairbanks Pioneers Home. We compared what our approximate cost is going to be if we were able to build today or very soon in the future, based on our cost and what the Pioneer Homes cost are. Our proposed project will cost per bed about $63,000 a year, as compared to the per bed cost of the current Pioneer Home, $119,000. So if we look at the savings for the 30-bed home, we're in 1 year going to be saving $1,680,000. And if we continue to go down that theme, we do believe our request of $13.9 million could be paid back to the state in approximately 8 years.
Well, we thank you for your presentation, and especially for your hard work, and just like your paperwork said, there's something that we need to look. Well, it's something not look at. We need to do this. I mean, that's maybe not your particular project, but we need to look at what we have to do for our senior citizens. And I know that, because all of us will be at that door someday. So, and it's an important issue. Are there any questions for Emily? Yep. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just, there's the Providence facility that just got built. I think it's a similar model, and I've toured that. So that's just for my familiarity. Is that true?
Representative Tarr, through the chair. Yes. Is it the Horizon House?
Yep.
Yes. And we did spend quite a bit of time down there. Very nice facility. I agree. The one difference in that home, that residence, and the one we are proposing is they are, again, private pay. Now, they will take a Medicaid waiver. They will take that amount of money, but they ask the family or someone else to subsidize the difference between that rate and the cost of private pay, around $7,000 a month. So that does limit the options for people who don't have those resources. Mm-hmm. But again, a lovely model. Very, very nice facility.
Representative Pruitt.
I just want to ask really quick. I mean, I'm just looking at your numbers here, and one of the things that just strikes me is, of course, you indicate that there's 175 units currently, if I understand this correctly. 2012, the estimated need was 1,100, and 2017 projected need of 2,000, and we're talking $15 million to provide 30. I mean, what is $15 million for 30? If we start doing that with trying to provide all of that, we'll go broke pretty quick. This is one option. What else is out there other than the 30 that you're offering to fill the gap? And I mean, is that something that we can sustain or get to?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, you're absolutely right. This is just not even a tip, just a tiny little fraction of the iceberg. Our organization has proposed a small project. We recognize 30 beds will begin to meet the need in the Fairbanks area. We want to do it for two reasons. One, we'd like to, down the road, propose three of these 30-bed facilities. We believe in a smaller or family home-like setting. However, we want to make sure this is a viable project. This, has risk for a nonprofit organization. We are proposing to put in $1.7 million and probably, I'm sure, some more of our own reserves toward this project as well. We believe we may have to do fundraising. We want to make sure the payer mix that we're proposing does work. We believe we will need a 60% private pay, 40% Medicaid. But as you know, when you open a facility, you can't guarantee that next person waiting at the door is going to be a private pay person. You're going to have to, in some cases, fill those vacancies very quickly. So I would say we are cautious and conservative in our approach. We very much realize that this is only one of a number that we need in Fairbanks. Around the state, you know, I have not heard of a lot of development going on, frankly. I think it's a good question. We have sought, stories or proposals or plans, and there may be some, but we are not aware of it. Folks are very concerned about the cost of operations once you have to commit to the development as well. If I could just add, I don't want to forget, as we're looking at the services that are provided in the homes, that is going to be another answer, that we make these services available through grant dollars around our state so that respite care, in-home support, adult day centers, tour services, et cetera, are increased to keep folks at home. That's going to be a very cost-effective piece of this solution.
Well, Representative Keller.
Good. And thanks, Emily. In your first point, the comparison there with the Pioneer Home, the $63,000 and $119,000, would you just talk about that a little bit? Why is there a difference? And just help me understand that.
Why there's such a difference.
Yeah.
In talking with the Pioneer Home, we understand there are several factors. One, because the Pioneer Home is state-run, there are union wages and benefits applied. And those are significantly higher than the cost we've used in our operational budget. I think that's a significant factor because, of course, your personnel costs are going to be 80 to 90% of your overall budget. You know, the large personnel budget to provide round-the-clock support 7 days a week. So that's going to be one of the biggest factors. The second is the maintenance of our Pioneer homes. Some of them are older, and there's quite a bit of maintenance that goes on annually. Those are the really two biggest factors. And then if you look at the other budget items, line items down the list, there is just increased costs all the way around, whether it's because of older homes, utilities, et cetera. But the personnel and the overall maintenance are the two biggest differences. We will not, in our nonprofit world, be paying union wages. And, of course, we'll have a new facility, and that's going to make a big difference. We also are designing with more efficient, energy-efficient design factors as well.
All right. Representative Keller, follow up.
Yeah, I just didn't want to pass while saying thanks for putting your work into this. And also just a comment, if you see things, regulations that the state has put out there in front of you where we have driven you to $63,000 and it might be even better, I would, for one, really appreciate hearing, so thank you.
Well, I would like to add that when we developed our budget, to be on the safe side, we did lose that lower reimbursement rate, which we feel is not sustainable around our state. But we did factor in a reimbursement rate for the Medicaid waiver at that lower reduced rate, which has now been held off, and we certainly would like to see it up back where it was, if not increased. We think this is the only way we're going to get the development that we need. You know, the mom and pops, the small mom and pops that we have around our state that are primarily providing the majority of our assisted living home care own their homes. They own their homes. That's why they can provide the services.
We've been in discussion on this, because this is an issue, and so we need to bring all the stakeholders together and brainstorm this, because it's not one silver bullet that's going to fix this. I think there's all sorts of different layers that need to happen so that we have a plan in place that will work for us. And so the discussion is happening, and hopefully we'll all come to a plan that will work. So with that, we appreciate your time and your effort, and especially presenting to the committee. Our next committee meeting is Tuesday, February 18th. We'll take up HB 214, which is the mental health patients' rights. And with that, we will adjourn at 4, is that 5? Yeah, 5 o'clock. Thank you.